Thank you for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. If you are looking for something new to listen to, there are a lot of other NPR podcasts, too, including great interviews, highlights from the week's news. We've got storytelling and entertainment, and you can browse it all at iTunes under podcasts. And that's the kicky music that means it is time again for Pop Culture Happy Hour. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. On this week's show, well, in the past, we've talked about swearing, and now we're going to talk about nudity. How movies and TV use it, how it affects story, and how it fits into the bigger artistic picture. Then we'll celebrate an upcoming holiday about math, yes, math, and talk about nerd celebrations and nerds in general with an actual certified expert. Then, as always, we'll talk about what's making us happy this week. Before we get started here in historic Studio 44, let's go around the table. Stephen Thompson, what do you do at NPR?
I am a writer and editor with NPR Music.
And Glenn Weldon, what do you do at NPR?
I write about books and comic books for the NPR website.
Well, specially shipped in for this week's shows, you know, specially relevant on both topics, I want to say, today, nudity and nerds, we've brought in Stephen's mother. Maggie Thompson.
Who is unclothed as we
talk. That is not true.
Trying to freak us all out.
Now, if I seem unusually quiet for the remainder of this episode, is that cool?
Maggie, why don't you explain to the people what your background is roughly in the area of nerd culture?
I grew up in a family in which my mom
I was born.
The dinosaurs, yes.
Mom was a science fiction writer you have never heard of, and this means that from a tender age I attended conventions and then went into my own direction of nerdity, which included marriage to Don Thompson, who was another nerd, and we produced another nerd who was Steven.
Stephen Begett.
But in the course of all that, Don and I co-edited Comics Buyer's Guide, so I am considered especially expert in comics, which I thought I was until I watched King of the Nerds the other night.
But before we get to nerds, the topic is nudity. Now, when we planned to discuss nudity, we did not know that we were going to be discussing nudity, yeah. That is, with one of our mothers.
I'm psyched.
I'll tell you a little bit about how we got on this topic, because I think it was my fault. The way we got on this topic was in part that we are taping this the day after the finale aired of HBO's True Detective, and there was a conversation that had emerged in the last couple of weeks about the use of nudity on True Detective. We had talked a few weeks ago about what was shown and not shown on HBO's Looking. Many people have talked about what's shown and not shown in Girls. But we sort of wanted to have a little bit broader conversation about what the purpose of that is, and much with our show about swearing. I would caution, in describing the kinds of nudity that we have seen, that we find significant.
Glad my mother's sitting next to me.
There may be adult content, which not all of you will want to experience with your children the way Maggie is. And so just be warned, there may be some adult content.
There may be a listing of body parts at some point.
There may be. I hardly know where to begin. I don't feel like I can begin with Maggie or Steven, so I feel like I have to begin with Glenn.
I have an idea, and I will defer to a much wiser person on this particular topic.
I would just like to say a few words about nudity in the world today. And I, for one, am just appalled by it. What? Did you know that underneath their clothing, the entire population of the world is walking around completely naked? Is that disgusting?
Is that disgusting? Okay, that, of course, is Sam the Eagle, who is building up to, the bit builds up to him realizing that birds, too, underneath their feathers are naked, and then we get the eyes going back and forth, because that's the money shot with Sam the Eagle. That's what you build up to.
Right.
Piggy header, hi-ya, he has the eyes going back
right,
and forth.
Right, right.
I introduced that because Sam is an American, and I would posit, I would say, that in American pop culture, we treat nudity generally differently than European pop culture, for example.
Absolutely.
And I would say further that in mainstream American pop culture, nudity has two purposes. It is to titillate or it is to disgust. So if your actors, for example, belong on a very narrow range of percent body fat, and they're also in a very narrow age range, it's offered to titillate, to arouse. If they do not fall into either one of those ranges, they're offered up as grotesques. And what I've always noticed about European pop culture is that it seems different. That dichotomy isn't as stark. And I had a theory, a half-baked theory, admittedly, that it had something to do with A, the amount of Puritan DNA in our sociological sure. makeup, and B, something about the long tradition of the nude as a subject of art in Europe, which saturated European culture for many, many years. So I had this theory, and I talked to an actual art historian, a friend
you
of mine.
You don't wow. say.
Yeah.
Wow.
A friend of mine who's the associate professor of history and theory of contemporary art at University of Wisconsin-Madison, as a matter of fact.
My alma mater.
The Michael J. McClure is his name, and he's brilliant, and he's very funny, and this is kind of
sure.
what he said. So the nude in European culture from the Renaissance on was a callback, a deliberate callback to the Greek and Roman ideas of symmetry and beauty, but it was also a covert way to engage ideas about sexuality and even humanism in this very Catholic environment. So it was kind of like a coded way to engage with sex in a way that was sort of safe because it was under the rubric of the Catholic Church. Because Europe embraced the psychoanalytic theory a little bit faster than we did back in the 50s and 60s, which is all about the sort of mechanics of sex and the physicality of sex and the actual body parts, they have a different attitude toward it. Now, we came about in a very Lutheran/Puritan mode. That's in our DNA, which comes with not only just a shame of the body kind of written into that, but also a larger austerity, a moral austerity, which shuns any kind of adornment or celebration of imagery, right? So in Europe, you have the idea of the image of the naked body is celebrated in various ways. Here, it is suspect. Here, it is historically a subject of shame. Now, there's one person I can think of who is kind of challenging that, and that's Lena Dunham on Girls, who is saying, I'm going to show you this naked body, and it does right. not conform. I want it to be arousing, but also I want it to engage you in a European way.
I think you make a very good point that I think Lena Dunham has reopened this debate in a really interesting way. And you have to get, in order to get to the parts of that debate that are interesting, you have to get past the part where everybody says, where certain people say, I don't want to look at her because she's ugly.
Right.
Right? She has an ugly body. I don't want to look at her ugly body.
Right.
And you also have to get past the part where she gets asked about this every time she does yeah. interviews. So if I were talking to her right now, this is not what I would be asking her about because she's answered this question 4 billion times and it rarely goes well. She got into a dust up with a critic who asked her not long ago, sort of, I don't get the point of the nudity on your show because it's clearly not supposed to be titillating.
Right, exactly.
So I don't get what the point of it is. It was very interesting to me because I think that guy was being very honest mm-hmm. about, you know, from his perspective, he was saying, I know what it is on Game of Thrones. On Game of Thrones, it's there to just be boobs, right? But I don't know what it is on your show because I don't think that's what it's supposed to be. And I think one of her points was the beginning of Girls, I remember they had a scene, maybe in the pilot, in the bathtub with the cupcake,
mm-hmm.
where Lena Dunham was sitting naked in a bathtub eating a cupcake, talking to one of her friends, not by herself, talking to one of her friends. And I felt like there was a clear purpose to the nudity in that scene, which was it was a very clear indicator of the level of intimacy
right.
she had with her friends, which was this is a very young girl kind of thing to do. Young women who just kind of walk around naked in front of each other. There is some of that. You know, not for everybody, but for certain kinds of girls, that is part of the intimacy of friendship at that age, especially people who shared an apartment together. You would get that kind of comfort level where, surprisingly enough, they would be doing that. And so I did think it served a very specific purpose. The ones where it tends to bother me a little bit more, where it doesn't seem to be for any particular purpose. And in fact, there was an interview that ran just the other day with the creator of True Detective, who was asked about all the nudity on that show, most of which is women. He said, it's sort of a mandate. I'd be just as happy not to have any.
Accent on man.
I mean, I gotta say, as a woman who watches that show, it's kind of like, well, okay. I mean, it's clearly not for me. So, you know.
Well, you bring up one of my reservations about it, and you would think I would have no reservations about nudity, and yet here we are, is the way so much nudity, the way it is packaged in particularly American pop culture, is I sometimes feel it's de-eroticized by the fact that you can almost feel the contract negotiations.
Yes,
behind
I think
it.
That's so true.
And so you'll watch a scene, you know, there's a scene there, you know, there's a scene in Wolf of Wall Street,
right,
where Leonardo DiCaprio is in bed with this very beautiful woman,
mm-hmm.
and he is, they're always cutting away from him,
yep.
you know, he's in his boxer shorts.
Yep.
He's, it's amazing how much clothing people wear when they're having sex in
yeah.
the movies.
Yeah.
And certainly who immediately put clothing back on afterward.
Right. Or who are shot from the side, or who always have a woman lying in front of them.
Right. And she is, you know, very lavishly framed
mm-hmm.
in her nude form,
mm-hmm.
and he is cut away. And, you know, that's a fairly obvious example. You assume you're not going to see full frontal Leonardo DiCaprio
right.
in Wolf of Wall Street. But the way that it's so often played out, where it's like, here is clearly what has been agreed to, it doesn't feel as much like it's serving a narrative purpose.
Right.
Compared to, for example, there's a lengthy scene in the movie Before Midnight.
That's exactly the one I was going to mention.
Yeah. Yeah, where Julie Delpy is topless, and she's topless because that's at the point they have gone from where she is half naked to where they are fighting.
Yeah.
And she is fighting the way a married couple would in that situation, where she doesn't necessarily feel a need to put a shirt on.
Right, exactly.
And so it is a much more natural feeling scene. It is a much more natural feeling use of nudity, where in many ways she seems much more exposed because
and she's, you get that claustrophobic feeling of them in the room in kind of the closeness of that marriage.
And it's not glamour shot framing.
No.
It's a very natural scene.
I completely agree. And with that, I want to go to your mother.
Great. I'm going to sit over here.
So Maggie, you know, you bring a mom's perspective to this conversation, but also a person's perspective. And I do not want to make it sound like we have brought you here to play mom to the discussion of nudity. I want to know what your reaction is to this.
When I was a youngster.
Okay. Take off my headphones.
There were two books in my house, Dad being a professor and Mom being an English major type. And the two books were Charles Gailey's Classic Myths in English Literature and in Art and Gustave Doré's Illustrations of Dante's Inferno. So I saw lots of naked people.
Uh-huh.
In books.
Some of them were in the books, yes.
Yeah.
Lots and lots and lots of them. So it wasn't that it was unusual for me to see such images, but I raised the question whether those were culture as opposed to popular culture.
Right.
That is, not a lot of other houses in our area had Dante's Inferno illustrated by Gustave Doré or Gailey's Classic Myths. What happened in the transition into popular culture, it seems to me, really hit in 1968. I looked up the dates of Wally Wood's Sally Forth, which was a comic strip done for the armed forces. And believe me, Sally took those clothes off as much as possible.
In Sally Forth?
It's a different Sally Forth.
Sally Forth.
No, I was thinking, I'm
going to stop you there.
It's like the pornier parts of Mary Worth are quite risque.
I believe I specified Wally Wood.
Yeah.
Did I not?
Yeah.
Glenn.
Linda, Wally Wood, Sally Forth.
Come on.
Well,
second, Robert Crumb's Zap
sure.
begins. So we have the underground comics coming in as an institution in a certain popular culture. And I later realized, and tip of the hat to Trey, Hair was on Broadway
yeah.
in 1968. Suddenly, everybody's taken off their clothes. So.
But you also had I Am Curious Yellow at about that same time. You had
True.
Last Tango in Paris
yep.
a little bit later.
A little later, yeah.
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 I think when you talk about popular culture for this purpose, the distinction that's useful to me to make between the books that you were talking about and popular culture is I think for the purposes of this conversation, there is a little bit of a difference between what is intended to be art and what is intended to be commerce.
Mm-hmm.
When you talk about trafficking in nudity, I mean, usually I feel like those lines are very blurry, and I think they are very blurry. I mean, it would be interesting to know whether if you're illustrating Dante's Inferno, you have that same incentive to, like, people would be more interested in my illustrations of Dante's Inferno if everyone in it is naked. I don't know the answer to that. I don't know how that would have been viewed at the time. But I do know that apparently for HBO, you got to put him in there just because you have to put him in there. And I do want to say, too, that one of the things that I think is important to point out about nudity in movies and TV, and as Stephen pointed out, there's a ton of contract negotiating that goes on. And there's a scene in Notting Hill where Julia Roberts, who's playing an actress, talks about the negotiating of nudity clauses, which I suspect comes directly out of real life.
Yeah.
There is a built-in gender disparity in nudity. There's an effective disparity, but there's also a built-in disparity in that we have no male equivalent of the boob.
True.
Right? We have, everybody has a butt, everybody has a front, you know.
This is NPR.
But there is no male equivalent of the boob. And the boob for an actress, the breast, the boob.
This is a really erotic conversation to be having in the same room as my mother.
The boob for an actress lives in a universe between the, it's hard to say where the boob and the butt are.
You're doing a taxonomy of nudity.
Yeah, but here's what I'm saying. Seeing actresses' breasts, like mainstream actresses' breasts, is incredibly common. Seeing people's naked behinds is quite common for women and for men. You even saw Matthew McConaughey's butt in True Detective.
And you see a lot of, you know, stunt butts, butt doubles.
Of course, butt doubles. But there is no male equivalent of kind of the, this is something that you wouldn't be allowed to see that is unique to a man.
Right.
Y'all don't have anything that you have to cover up when you're in public that is the equivalent of that. So whenever you're trying to, whenever you talk about nudity on television and in movies, 90% of the time, if you're not talking about behinds, which people tend to get a little bit less even networks have occasionally had butts. 95% of these conversations about nudity, how much nudity, which shows have nudity, 95% of that is a conversation about boobs. And it's false to pretend it isn't.
Right.
And so the other thing that I thought was very interesting in that same True Detective interview is that he sort of said the same thing that Steven said about you wouldn't expect to see full frontal Leonardo DiCaprio. The creator of that show was saying, like, well, naturally, you're not going to have these two big movie stars who are going to go full frontal, right? And in this case, it's Matthew McConaughey and Woody Harrelson, which is fine. But he sort of was allowing a couple things at the same time. A, it's a network requirement. Mm-hmm. B, I made my show about two guys, and they're not going to want to do it.
Right.
Because given a choice, actors with power don't want to do it. But somebody has to do it. So it winds up being in the form of all these anonymous prostitutes and
strippers. You know, any scene that's set in a strip club.
And victims of violence and all this stuff. You make your show about men. The men aren't going to do it, partly because actors with power aren't going to do it. It falls to boobs. And I think that happens on quite a lot of shows, to be honest, where if you look at, like, quote unquote prestige television right now, the vast majority of those shows are centrally about men. The men aren't going to be terribly naked most of the time. According to this guy, it's something of a mandate to have a certain amount of nudity. That's going to be boobs. And it's going to be boobs when the stars of your project are not showing anything particularly private or secret.
Right.
There are a couple of examples of male nudity that I actually did want to bring up. One is, you know, we talked briefly about the show Looking. Mm-hmm. It's on HBO. It follows girls. It's about gay life. And we had discussed how explicit does this show get. I happened to catch a later episode of that show in which it gets significantly more explicit and significantly more revealing, not to the extent that many might hope. The other example that I wanted to bring up was Jason Segel in the movie Forgetting Sarah Marshall, who is a fairly big name actor. It's somewhat of a Lena Dunham situation in which he is writing his own story in which he is fully frontally nude and crying. And it's this very, very, very memorable scene, in part because you just don't see that in movies
I think that's, yeah.
And what it's underscoring there is what we talked about before, vulnerability, intimacy, as opposed to titillation, as opposed to he's gross. There's something that happens in the middle there. I was a teenager in the 80s, and I came along just when the male body was being sexually objectified. Yay! Because in the 70s, you just had to be skinny and have good hair, and you got away with it. But in the 80s, with Marky Mark and the Funky Bunch, good vibrations.
To a lesser extent, the Funky Bunch.
The Solaflex ads, oh boy, and the Calvin Klein ads, of course.
I have a feeling we're taking a little side trip into Glenn's maturation process here.
I merely point out that now we had unrealistic standards of beauty that we could not attain, just like everybody else. Mm-hmm. Yay. But, I mean, I think the point you were getting at about how there is no equivalent, the toned muscular torso is kind of inching its way toward being something that doesn't quite get to the level of breasts, as it were. Right. But it is prized in a way. And when you see a woman wake up in bed in a bra, for example, mm-hmm. or you see a dude get out of bed and have this incredible ripped eight-pack. I mean, we're talking about 5% of the population who, in Hollywood terms, are 80% of the population.
Sure.
Right.
That's equal opportunity. And when it comes to the subject of what I call torso art, so gay men of a certain age, let's say, when you go over to their house and you see a lot of torso art, a lot of sculptures of Greek statuary, that they're trying to pass off as that they're aesthetes, they're highly cultured. When, in fact, dude, what you have there is a blonde rubbing up against Camaro. That's basically for you. It's the same thing. So don't try to pass it off as anything but that.
I don't know. But the thing about the torso is, like, it's not so privatized, right? It's not like
it's
you're allowed to, but you're allowed to, like, walk around with that hanging out.
Right.
Yes,
you know what I mean?
I encourage people to do it.
But you know what I'm saying? Like, that's why there's no equivalent to the boob. Like, the boob remains, like, something where, you know, you're getting, like, a peek.
Right.
When you see a torso, you're not getting a peek. That does not come across as getting a peek at someone's goodies because you're allowed to walk around on the street like that. Women can walk around on the street with their belly buttons out,
what
too.
What do you think, though, of this rubric, this notion that women are more verbal and men are more visual? What do you take of that?
Yeah, I don't know. Garbage.
Okay, good. Elaborate.
Because anyone who has seen the bedroom of a teenage girl mm-hmm. and looked at the posters that are on the wall and says that she doesn't care about visual attributes, it hasn't got a clue.
That's just men being hopeful.
Yeah.
Well, I think there may be certain truth to it. I mean, like Maggie said, if you think women are not walking around admiring people aesthetically, that's just insanity.
Right. There's this whole branch called evolutionary psychology, which tries to kind of reduce men and women to their wiring. And
right.
Say, well, just this is why men cheat, because they just need right. to go out there
right.
and do
sure.
that. And that is such crap. What that ignores willfully is that, you know what else evolved? Society. Culture.
Right.
To kind of take these base urges and process them in a way. I mean, right. like, I'm sitting in an SEO meeting for 3 hours. Do I want to fling poo at somebody? Yes, I do. But I don't.
All right, we have moved from nudity.
Because of society.
We have moved from nudity to poo flinging, and unfortunately, that means it's time to wrap it up. So you should come and find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH. Bring your mom and let us know what you think about nudity and what she thinks about nudity. And, you know.
Why don't you ask her? Why don't you sit in a room with her?
Sit in a room with her. Ask her what she thinks about nudity. That's what we would do. So the other topic this week we think is going to make Stephen a little more comfortable about having his mother in the room. Maybe. I don't know. So this episode is coming to you for the first time on Friday, March 14th, also known as Pi Day. But what it is it's Pi Day, PI 3.14159, et cetera. That is the consistent ratio between the circumference of a circle and the diameter. It's my favorite number thing with the exception of the Fibonacci sequence. So what we got thinking about with Pi Day is that it is sort of one of the few things that you could say is a really emphatically nerd holiday. Like, the only people who get excited about a day celebrating a number are going to be, we could say nerds, but we could also say enthusiasts,
uh-huh.
right? Number enthusiasts. And we were thinking about nerd holidays and nerd celebrations in general. We figured that while we had Maggie visiting us, that we would talk a little bit about nerd culture and its trip into the mainstream and when it gets its moments to shine, such as Pi Day. So, Maggie, I guess what I want to ask you is there a comic book nerd equivalent of Pi Day?
It exists now.
It exists now?
Right now.
Yeah?
Yep.
Did you invent it?
No. A man named Joe Field invented it in a magazine I co-edited.
How did you?
And Diamond Comic Distributors picked it up. And the first Saturday in May, every May, is Free Comic Book Day.
Oh, it's almost time again. Yep.
Go to the shops. You will get free comic books.
We talk about it every year.
We do.
please, please, everyone, locate your shops. If you can't find them, go online and Google Free Comic Book Day, and there is a locator service to help you find your local shop. Now, that said, since it already exists, perhaps we need to turn to April as the lead up, because that could be Pop Culture Month.
What do you think about that, Stephen?
First of all, I think the most important thing we can do is if we can create a pop culture holiday that squashes one of the idiot holidays we have now, I would gladly welcome a Pi Day becoming the new President's Day or the new Columbus Day, mm-hmm. the holidays that exist solely to make us wonder why the bank is closed. So I would like to squash one of those. I think, first of all, every day is Nerds Day. I think we can agree on that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we'll talk about that.
In this day and age, the way that my own mother used to squash my criticisms of Mother's Day and Father's Day by explaining that every day is Children's Day, we are now in a world where I'm not sure nerds need just one day. I'm not sure that nerds... It's nerds' world now.
Right. There is one comic book holiday, another comic book holiday besides Free Comic Book Day, that has gotten a push recently, which is Read Comics in Public Day. Now, I'm all for that, but again... Every day is Read Comics in Public Day. So even though it's great and it does help some of the people who aren't ready to kind of move past their own internalized comixophobia, that's great. Any of these things, though, to me, like Talk Like a Pirate Day or May the 4th Be With You,
uh-huh.
or there is an entire Tumblr now devoted to just creating the Back to the Future time code where, you know, it says this is the day that Marty uh-huh. went into the future. Mm-hmm. There's one for each day of the year so that somebody will find it and, oh my God, this is the day. And they said, uh-huh. all of these strike me as stupid. I just, whenever somebody starts talking like a pirate on my social media, I want to say to them what I'm sure they've heard before, which is, why are you hitting yourself? Why are you hitting yourself? Why are you hitting yourself? Because it's like they're calling attention to this thing that they're so enthusiastic about. And as much as I am all for nerd pride, I feel about it the same way I feel about gay pride, which is a little shame. Also, maybe a little shame. Maybe a little bit. Maybe not so much with the pride. Maybe dial it back a little.
Why do you not like pride?
Because, again, as Stephen said, we're all nerds now. Now, Maggie was there to see.
Maggie was ostracized.
Maggie was there when fire was invented.
Look, I'm doing research now about the 60s Batman television show, and I'm comparing the 60s Batman television show, how it was received in the public, to among the fanzine press. Like, there was a fanzine I'm sure you're aware of called Batmania, which predated the 60s
Bill
show.
Bill Joe White.
Bill Joe Wright. And you can see this slow motion car crash happening with subsequent issues of this fanzine where before they're like, we're in contact with producers and it's going to be great. And can you imagine seeing a big pow pop up on the screen when Batman hits somebody? It's going to be awesome. And then this one happens after the series premieres. We're like, oh, well, that was not what we had in mind. And then finally, the one I was like, it's the worst thing I've ever seen. They're making fun. You can just see it happening. But you were there, Maggie, to see this thing that you're so passionate about, this thing that you love, get mainstream acceptance. Because at the time of this particular, this era I'm talking about, comic books were not only dismissed as like not thought about, but disdained. Because that taint from the 50s of their poisoning children's minds was still there. And in fact, you know, Dozier, the guy who produced the Batman show, was all like, nobody reads them except for idiots and children. And it's like, wow. He said this to a letter to the Batman fanzine. Right? This is kind of tone deaf, but it was so ingrained. So talk to a little bit about how you saw that change.
If I may ask a specific question.
Please do.
When did you know that comic books had passed from thing that people would kind of broadly make fun of to thing that was pretty broadly accepted as a part of mainstream popular culture? Is there that moment?
Probably Comic-Con actually helped it to grow because it was such a media event that even if you didn't care about comic books, people dressed up and had a fun party and, oh, I want to go to that.
Well, the Comic-Con is essentially a pop culture convention at this
point. Absolutely. Right. Has always been. And year after year you hear the, oh, Comic-Con isn't about comics. Comic-Con has always been about popular culture. And the very first Comic-Con that there ever was in San Diego, one of the guests of honor was Forry Ackerman, who did Famous Monsters of Filmland.
Right.
So it was always movies. It was always fun. It was always, let's talk about all the cool things things we collect, and, oh, wait a minute, you have that copy, and I don't, and I'll trade you, you know, four issues of Lois Lane for one copy of
Superman. I don't know, man.
Superman.
It used to be about the marketing, man.
But in the 1950s, there were comic book burnings.
Yeah.
And that is one reason that the old comic books are worth money today.
It's interesting. I don't have a specific holiday to suggest. My take is basically the same as Glenn's, that any function that holidays like this, or frankly that celebrations like Comic-Con have, is sort of the identifying of your tribe in a lot of ways.
Right.
I understand there are other functions to Comic-Con if you want to buy stuff and see trailers. And if you want to wait in line for 6 hours to see trailers, that is the best place to do it. So if you can find people who like the same weirdsy things that you do,
right.
And that is like half of what I use Twitter for.
Scarlet
I use
nerdy letter. Just
it's one of my favorite things to do on Twitter. I throw out a quote from like some obscure television show I don't think anybody cares about, and you find like the five people who care.
Who care about It's Your Move.
It's Your Move.
I do think that Free Comic Book Day is an interesting example of where you're most likely to get a worthwhile nerd holiday, which is it is advancing an agenda that is celebrating and perpetuating something that is glorious about nerd culture. And I would bring up, as you know, music person in this room, the example of Record Store Day,
right.
Which, I mean, at Record Store Day in April, but then you also, now you have your Record Store Day on Black Friday, and hey, can we fit another Record Store Day? Hey, how about we have everybody go to their record stores all the time?
Well, and eventually you can bet there's going to be some variation on See a Movie in a Theater Day.
Oh, absolutely. That's true.
See a Movie on the Big Screen Day.
Well, yeah, but they're motivated all by what nerds are at heart, which are, as you say, enthusiasts. They're not hipsters. Enthusiasts wants to share.
Yeah.
The hipster wants to protect against the bulwark, you know, to protect against the hordes of people who come in too late.
And this is why nerds / enthusiasts will make you tired.
Right.
If you don't dole it out to yourself carefully, because that desire to share becomes a desire to shove, as it were, upon others.
Sure. And however, a core in the nerd community, the hardcore of the nerd community, that can fester into hipsterism, that can go off the deep end. And you see it happening in 1966 for the first time, where there's actually an instance that I found of nerd rage, where somebody punches another dude who is wearing a Batman t-shirt because it was the wrong kind of Batman. That is nerd, right?
Yeah.
That is the dark side of this whole thing, where it kind of goes off the deep end.
Well, there's also the criticism that occurred, speaking of 1966, at the World Science Fiction Convention when Star Trek was introduced before it aired on NBC. And then the next year, the hardcore, I don't look at television, were incensed because suddenly there were women coming to the convention, and Bijou Trimble stood up and she said, "You've been begging for women to come to the conventions for years. Now they are, and now you're complaining about Star Trek."
Exactly.
Yeah, well, and frankly, at Comic-Con, one of the first times that I was really aware of a big dust-up over Comic-Con had to do with Twilight and how offended people were that Twilight came to Comic-Con, which to me was like, it's not comics, but there are lots of things there that aren't comics, as Maggie was saying before, and nobody gets upset when it's like Community's going to be at Comic-Con.
Sure.
That's not comics. That's just television. Twilight's just a movie. All right. Well, I think that we would take all incoming suggestions regarding nerd holidays, nerd culture, your thoughts. Again, facebook.com/PCHH or on the blog at npr.org/PCHH. And that brings us to our final segment. What is making us happy this week? Stephen Thompson, besides the presence of your almost impossibly charming mother.
Yes.
What else is making you happy this
week? No, all I have is the presence of my impossibly charming mother. No, actually, I had my impossibly charming mother here all over through the weekend. And speaking of nerds, we mainlined the first two seasons thus far of King of the Nerds, which we've recommended on this show a number of times, to have my children indoctrinate my mother in this particular show, which, you know, it brings it brings a tear to the eye of this old warhorse. Most of my fixations have been South by Southwest related. When this episode airs, I will be down there tweeting about bands. But I do, just if I'm going to recommend something new and charming that probably most people have seen, I do highly recommend, if you haven't seen it, Googling Jurassic Park Cat Raptor, in which a pivotal scene from the movie Jurassic Park is digitally recreated in such a way that the two children are running from gigantic house cats.
Wow.
There you go.
I'll take it.
You talk about nerd culture. I got your nerd culture right there.
I like it, Stephen. Maggie Thompson, what is making you happy this week other than being impossibly charming?
Well, Stephen stole mine. We didn't consult before here. It was Pounding Down King of the Nerds, 2 seasons. I do note that statements on that show such as all nerds love math, not true.
Not true. Emphatically
no,
not.
That is definitely not true.
And when they're talking about science fiction and fantasy, it's primarily televisual and motion picture rather than
books.
Yep. And in fact, reading, not a lot.
You get nitpicks for King of the Nerds. just take a moment. The fact that they say
sci-fi on the show,
yes.
And that my mother did not yell at the TV that it's not science fiction. It should be SF.
There you go.
Yes. Yes, there is nerdier than King of the Nerds.
Also on March 14th, Veronica Mars.
The Veronica Mars movie is true. Many, many people very excited about that.
I have a T-shirt.
Wonderful, wonderful. Glenn Weldon, what is making you happy this week?
This is going to be near and dear to Maggie's heart. A piece of trivia from 1944. This was the heyday of superhero comics, really. During the war, there was just all kinds of superheroes. All kinds of publishers came into business just to do superhero comics. One, a tiny little publisher called Rural Home, published Blazing Comics, which had a hero in it called the Green Turtle. This was written and drawn by a guy named Chu Hing, a Chinese-American. And the Green Turtle defended China, which was then an ally of the United States, against the hordes of Japanese that were coming in, and he defended them with guerrilla warfare. He had a costume, but no powers. That's what we know for a fact. The legend is that Chu Hing asked his publisher if he could make the Green Turtle Chinese. Publisher said no. So what we see over the course of these 5 or 6 issues is the Green Turtle fighting the Japanese, but we never see his face. We see over his shoulder, and when he does turn to basically the reader, his arm goes up over his face, or there's a shadow that falls over his face. So the rumor is that Chu Hing defied his publisher by making the Green Turtle Chinese. But we never got an origin story until today. There's a new graphic novel called The Shadow Hero by Jean Luen Yang, who you know from American Born Chinese and Boxers and Saints, 2 great books, who is the writer, and Sunny Liu, who is the artist, and it's basically the origin story of the Green Turtle. And it is such a charming book because the conceit is that this kid has a mom who is enraptured, just loves the whole idea of American superheroes. So she wants her son to become a superhero and he wants nothing to do with it. She makes him a costume. He won't wear it. Early on in the book, there's a truck that turns over in their neighborhood, which toxic waste, and they go over to see it. And then at one point, the mother just sort of pushes him into the toxic waste. Just kind of like, boop. And it doesn't give him superpowers, but it does, as he says, it gave him a high-grade fever that lasted a week. It's a great book. You should really check it out. It's called The Shadow Hero by Jean Luen Yang and Sunny Liu.
Wonderful. Nice. Thank you, Glenn. So people who have followed me on this show and other media know, some of you, that one of my big complaints about pop culture has been the lack of availability for me to watch Murphy Brown. Now, if you want to talk about origin story, Murphy Brown is a big part of my personal origin story because she talked too much. She was unapologetic about it. They never undid that about her. She was extremely good at her job as a journalist. And for me, she was really one of the most interesting women on television at that time. And I was flipping around the other day and I discovered that Encore, which mostly runs movies, has a couple of TV shows that they run, one of which is Murphy Brown, one of which is also Night Court, by the way. And so I discovered that on demand, on Encore, I could watch not all, but a bunch of Murphy Brown. And I haven't seen that show in years because it hasn't been on syndication in a long time. And they put out the first season on DVD and nobody bought it, so they didn't put out anymore. So for me to uncover suddenly the ability to rewatch the episode where she landed the, at that time, substantially younger and quite sexy Scott Bakula, not that he's not still, but at that time, as a guy who thought that the fact that she never shut up was sort of awesome, was just so promising to me. I mean, come on. That's a great story. And the fact that I found this on Encore on demand was absolutely what was making me happy this week. Now, at least one person told me that she tried to find it on Encore on demand and she couldn't. I personally have Comcast. I don't know if it depends on your cable system. Encore on demand had it on my cable system. I was so excited. don't know what to say. So I'm going to go and watch some more. So Murphy Brown on demand on Encore. And it makes me so happy because I haven't seen it in a long time. And as we've said on this show, it's very rare anymore to get the opportunity to have absence make the heart grow fonder because there's so little absence.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
So that's what's making me happy. And that brings us to the end of our show. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me at NPR Monkey C. You can follow Stephen at I Dislike Stephen, STEPHEN. You can follow Maggie at Thompson Maggie. Thompson Maggie makes perfect sense. You can follow Glenn at G.H. Weldon, WELDON. You can follow our pal Trey Graham at Trey Graham, Trey with an E, Graham like the cracker. You can follow our producer Jessica Reedy at Jessica_Reedy. And you can follow our also producer Nick Fountain at Nick Fountain, Nick like Nick, Fountain like Fountain. You can follow our esteemed producer emeritus and music director Mike Katziff at Mike Katziff, KATZIF. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our in-and-out music, which you are tapping your foot to right now. So thanks to all of you for being here.
Thank you.
And thanks to all of you for listening, and we will see you back here next week. Thank you for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. If you are looking for something new to listen to, there are a lot of other NPR podcasts too, including great interviews, highlights from the week's news. We've got storytelling and entertainment, and you can browse it all at iTunes under podcasts.